morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Monday, February the 17th, 2003. And at this time, I would like to have, and that's going to be great coming up on this.
Mr. Streisinger, who's
okay,
the
well
director.
Okay, well, come on up, and we're going to hear the answer to additional questions. So we'll do that at this time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Greg Malakasian, the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and today we provided you another letter. It's dated February 17th that answers the questions that came up in the hearing last Thursday. The first item that we provided as an attachment is the information that you had requested that support the statistics that were discussed by Gabe Silva, the manager of the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. And that's as attachment one. There are actually two items there, the press release and the report. And we've also provided a link to the full report if you want to pull the complete General Accounting Office report down off the Internet. The second item, Senator George, you had requested some information regarding what percent of non-compliant employers thought that they didn't need workers' compensation coverage because they were independent contractors. And while we don't have specific information to that question, we can answer in part that we do know that 30% of our non-compliant employer investigations involve an independent contractor issue. And so that's about 180 cases out of 600 that we performed in the year 2002. And in there were 10 claims that we found the claimant non-subject. That meant that the injured worker that filed the claim had indicated that they were a subject worker, but we found that they probably did have independent contractor status and were not subject to the workers' compensation law. And then the next item on page two was a question that Representative Smith had asked, and Senator George, you had asked for some additional information on it as well, and it was the basis for the interest income calculation for the fund balance of each division. And we've provided a narrative that that basically tells how we go about that, estimating the future short-term and long-term interest rates and how that ties into the Office of Economic Analysis at the Department of Administrative Services. And then we break out the explanation of investment income based upon the income earned on a portfolio of bonds through the Treasury Department. And then interest income is that portion of the fund balance that's not invested in bonds but earns interest at the current short-term earnings rate, and we maintain a certain amount there because of cash flow demands. And then there was a specific question about how was this interest rate calculated for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, and we give the specific example there that shows at the time that we prepared our forecast, we were anticipating using an average balance of that fund that the forecasted annual return would amount to 5.53%. And the one of the key things from this is that overall every one of the funds are managed in a similar way, and so you could apply this to all funds. Thank you. Representative Krieger had asked what type of business startups are minority and women owned, and we've attached the list of those at attachment three, and if there are any questions on that. And then, Ms. Lamont, you had requested that we provide a copy of the report that we gave to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology, and that's provided at attachment four. And then finally, there was a question, and I don't remember if it came up near the very end of the hearing, but we thought it would be helpful to provide some information about the internal audit functions. There was kind of a discussion, I believe, about, well, why do you have internal audit functions? So I provided the reference to the Department of Administrative Services Accounting Manual, where they lay out the criteria that they believe agencies should apply when considering whether to have an internal auditor. And those three criteria are that the total biennial expenditures exceed $100 million, which the DCBS does. The agency has more than 400 FTE, which we do. And the agency processes over $10 million in cash annually, which we do. Since we exceed all three of these thresholds, we do employ one internal auditor in our agency. So that completes the presentation of the information requested from the last session.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And in addition to the material which Mr. Malkasian has covered, you asked some very important questions during your discussion of the department's central services support last Thursday, and I appreciate the opportunity to come back to the subcommittee and discuss some of the questions that were raised. I want to start with a couple of general comments, if I could, and then get into some of the specifics that came up last week. First, when I presented the agency overview to you a week and a half ago, I mentioned that one of the department's strategic initiatives for the coming biennium is program evaluation. We are developing a department-wide process to review the costs and benefits of each of our programs, including a look at whether particular functions are still needed, and if so, whether there are better or more cost-effective means of achieving our ends. And I can assure you that our support service areas will be included in this review and evaluation process. This agency has been fairly aggressive in the past in eliminating or scaling back functions that are no longer needed, but in the current economic climate, this effort has to continue and redouble, and the central support areas are certainly no exception. Second, I want to reiterate a comment that Mr. Malkasian made to you last Thursday. These central support areas have the same mission as the rest of our department, which is to protect and serve Oregon consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. Everything the support areas do is aimed at either delivering services directly to Oregonians or making sure that the operating divisions can do so most effectively and cost efficiently. So how do we make sure that the support service divisions are sized correctly, and particularly when we're looking at the needs of the operating areas as well? I want to address this directly because there may have been some misunderstanding on Thursday about how the decisions are made. Although the support services are centralized, the decision-making is not. And in fact, I've been very impressed with this department's collaborative management system and approach to this to decision-making. I believe our materials mention the executive team, and a question came up last week about how many FTE are associated with the executive team. The answer is none. The executive team consists of the administrators and deputies in each of the divisions, along with myself, Mr. Malkasian, and a few of our key staff. This group, then representing the department as a whole, meets as a team to make decisions on issues which affect the department, including what level of support services should be provided centrally and what should be provided at the division level. The ground rules for the team are that each person is supposed to leave his or her division hat at the door and look for solutions that best meet everybody's needs. I have to say, in my few weeks working with that group, it's a pretty impressive process. And it's one that I was particularly glad to see in place when I came in, because my personal style is to look for collaborative management. I certainly don't favor the command and control style, and I think that was one of the concerns, in fact, that had been raised last week. So when we talk to you about particular functions being performed on a centralized or department-wide basis, that's as a result of that collaborative process in which all divisions are involved. It's not a top-down management directive. And as a general rule, of course, the functions that end up in those support divisions are those which, department-wide, it's agreed, can be performed more cost-effectively and with a greater degree of expertise by having them centralized, with the direct goal of better service to our customers. So with that general background, I'd like to discuss a couple of the support areas about which you raised some specific questions last week. And I'd like to start with our Information Management Division, which provides information technology and research services. Your budget materials show an increase of 3 FTE in this division, but as Mr. Malkasian explained on Thursday, these 3 information technology positions were, in fact, approved during the last session and were part of our 2001-2003 budget. They are reflected in the 2001-2003 budget in the specific operating divisions. They were administratively moved to the information management decision through the decision-making process that I've just outlined, so that the work could be better coordinated with the rest of our information technology staff. We've provided you with quite a bit of written material about our technology initiatives, which are aimed at supporting the needs of the operating areas and providing better service to the public, as well as reducing costs. I believe a committee member commented last Thursday that technology is always described as reducing costs, but you asked us to show you those cost savings, and I would like to give you a few examples. In our insurance division, our chief financial examiner used to spend 2 or 3 days a week in the field, traveling from office to office to monitor the progress of financial exams. We now have those exam materials online on a secure website so that he can check on the progress of those exams from his office, save that travel time. In addition, the insurance companies being examined used to be required to provide paper copies of their financial documents, which could fill up 7 or 8 banker's boxes for each company. Those materials are now mostly provided electronically, which saves time and cost for the insurance companies and for our examiners, as well as, of course, saving archive space. This and other technology improvements have, in fact, resulted in considerable savings in time and personnel. Over the past 10 years, for example, the number of licensed insurance agents in Oregon grew by 139%, and the insurance premiums written increased by 59%, but the insurance division, due to some of these technology improvements, is able to handle this very substantially increased workload with no additional FTE.
I have no doubt about any of that. I'm sure it's all true. So how come your budget's going up 4 people and $5 million for this section?
For this section, it is going up 3 positions, 3 FTE, and those are not actually increases.
Four in our.
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
But maybe you've done something since we got our budget.
Maybe so.
Yeah, I'm down at the bottom of the page.
You're looking at central support services as well.
That's the point.
Yes.
I keep tripping over
yes.
here.
I'm sorry. Three in information management, 3 in personnel services, a reduction of 2 elsewhere is where we get the 4.
Okay.
The information management positions are not actually new positions this biennium. Those positions were created last biennium through the Ways and Means process. But they were located, even though they were performing the same information management functions, they were located in the divisions, and they've now been moved, same positions, same functions, same cost structure, moved to the Central Information Management Division in order to coordinate their work better with our other information management functions. So that is...
Explain that on Friday.
And it's not a change, it's not an increase, it is an effort to perform more efficiently. With respect to the Office of Personnel Services, which is the other area where we show an increase, and these positions and I believe that Greg mentioned this on Thursday as well, they were initially filled on a limited duration basis, and they were established on a permanent financing basis during the past biennium based on vacancies elsewhere in the department. And due to the timing of the budget cycle, this is the first opportunity that you've had to review them. So it's legitimate to say that those are, in fact, new positions, although they have been in place for a while. What that means from my perspective is that for your review purposes, we can tell you what those positions are actually delivering rather than speculating about what they would deliver if we added them. And I'd like to tell you about what those positions are delivering so that you can make a choice about that.
I think for whatever it's worth, I don't have any problem with state delivering more services except this time around.
I understand that.
And I think we've hit a point where we can only deliver so many services, and we don't have to deliver all the services that we're delivering. So I'm just going to have a real hard time getting to 35 $35 million for central services in your agency.
If I can, I'd like to go through what we deliver with some of those services. I know you hear this from every agency. We actually want to use the to increase services in one area only if it saves us costs and work in other areas. And that's what I think these positions do.
So I should be able to go to other parts of the budget and see decreases?
And you do,
more
and
than
can.
Just that
yes.
The folks have moved from one section
yes.
to another.
If you look at our budget as a whole,
okay.
and you net out the building codes package, because that's a separate policy issue, you will still see overall a drop in FTE for our department this biennium.
Okay.
But within that, you do see movement here and there inside the department. Let me take a couple minutes to talk about the Office of Personnel Services, because that is the area where there, from a budget standpoint, over at least a couple of biennium, there is an actual increase. And there are three positions. The first of these is a safety risk specialist, and this was actually a recommendation from our OSHA division. To improve our workplace safety and reduce injuries. Since establishment of this position, we've seen a 77% reduction in time lost days due to worker injuries in the department and a 62% reduction in medical and time loss costs paid. It's a cost saving to the department, and of course it also improves productivity through keeping our employees at work, as well as, of course, improving safety and preventing those injuries to our employees. The second of the three positions is a training specialist with a focus on customer service training. And you've heard about our customer service initiative as a way of making sure that our services are delivered in the best possible way to our customers. We think we get better results as well as lower costs by being able to develop tailored training programs in-house rather than contracting out, which is the standard way that many customer service programs are handled. The third position is an additional personnel officer, and with this position over the past several years, we've been able to ensure greater accountability on the part of management and our workforce in areas such as wage and hour compliance, internal controls, and proper workforce classification. When we handle these areas well, it's difficult to actually show you successes, because success is the absence of problems and the absence of the costs that can arise from handling these areas poorly. We don't want this agency to be the next example of improper employment practices, and we work very hard to avoid that. But I can give you one specific example of success in this area that's very recent. It was just brought to my attention. I wanted to mention it because it relates to building codes specifically, and we're very concerned about keeping building codes costs down. We work hard to maintain good working relationships with our unions and to avoid problems or address issues before they become problems. Our building codes workforce is represented by AFSCME, and we have just learned that AFSCME and the state have agreed to simply renew our collective bargaining agreement for 2003-2005, with the exception of statewide pay and benefits issues, of course. And that's rather than engaging in the very time-consuming process of renegotiation. AFSCME has said that this was possible due to the work of our Office of Personnel Services and our building codes managers during the last biennium, who have met with increasing success and mutual respect, and I'm quoting here, to identify and resolve these problems. We believe actually that this is unprecedented, to be able to roll over a bargaining agreement rather than renegotiate it, and it will be a significant savings in time and costs to our building codes division. One of the other central support areas, which you've seen in your materials, the other large one, is the Business Administration Division. Personnel, as you're probably aware, is just 17 FTE. Business Administration and Technology are much larger. In the Business Administration Division, I could go through and give you the statistics of the volume of work that we handle, but you probably don't need to see that. I do want to, again, give you a specific example that relates to building codes. We're very focused on making sure that our support services deliver value in this area. And, for example, during the current biennium, the Business Administration Division has worked with Building Codes to simplify their accounting structure to reduce the number of accounting transactions for the Building Codes Division. And due to this effort, we're seeing a savings to Building Codes of slightly over $400,000 compared to last biennium. So I, although I can't go through every line item with you, I feel fairly sure in being able to tell you that the provision of central support services does deliver value and reduce costs to the operating divisions. But I do want to come back to a couple of comments I made at the beginning of my presentation this morning, which is that we absolutely have to engage in a continuing evaluation process, that we cannot take for granted that we can keep central, or should keep any central support service programs at their current level any more than any other programs in this department. It's our job to make sure that we're only delivering the functions that are absolutely necessary to accomplish our mission, and we understand that in these economic times, that's more of a challenge than ever. Secondly, I do want to reiterate what I said initially about the decision-making process, which is this is not centralized decision-making. There's no top-down structure for saying we want more services in central support or less here or we need to reallocate here. The executive team that reviews and evaluates these issues is not a separate body. It consists of the administrators and deputies in each of the divisions who collectively decide how best to deliver services for each of their program areas. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I absolutely understand that in this climate, we cannot simply be adding more. We need to be able to figure out ways to do more with less. That's a commitment I can make to you, and I believe this budget does that, but I have been working with it for only a few weeks, and I can certainly commit to you whatever choices you make in handling our budget that we will continue to apply a rigorous screen to these services. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
This has been a great job.
You know, either that or I've been so unconvincing that there's that nobody wants to ask me. I do appreciate your time, and at any time I'll be happy to answer questions individually as will the staff of the department.
Mr. Chairman, yes, my only comment would be if they do building codes, because if there was a problem area in state government, building codes was it on the consumer side as well as on the business side. So I feel confident about being able to help support the support services piece because of that. Because if there was ever an area of business development that was lacking, it was the attitude and the behavior of the workers in that area. It stunk. And so to be able to have the unions come to the reality of why they need to join forces with building codes is the area. Because if you guys have not done something, I'm sure this committee would have done something. Because it was uncalled for.
Senator Dukes.
No offense, but I don't think it was building codes. I think it was the Construction Contractors Board. And the two, to many people, are indistinguishable, but they're two separate agencies.
Okay.
And that's the one where we've had the problems and the lack of
that's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I got
yeah.
these two confused.
Didn't want to cooperate, didn't
yes.
want to help. They've gotten a lot better in the last few years,
yeah.
too. But, yeah, I think building codes has had its problems, don't get me wrong.
I stand corrected. That's the area.
Yeah.
Construction contractor. Yes.
The one I keep suggesting that we could move into DCBS and have a better performance.
I know you've got to work on that.
Oh, I'd like to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if there aren't any further comments on Ms. Streisinger's presentation, I did want to briefly highlight this handout that is sitting in front of you. You will start to see this same handout on other agencies that are coming forward in the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee. This is from the Oregon Progress Board, and it lists all of the related benchmarks for agencies that will be in front of this committee. It looks like this. There are two documents that are fairly similar looking. One of them has got a yellow highlight on it. Maybe that would help.
So we're working on the yellow highlighter.
Yeah, we're looking at this one. And I just distributed this to you for your information. It isn't something that the agency is presenting, nor is it something that LFO mm-hmm. is presenting, but it does highlight the linkage between the agencies that are in this committee and the Oregon benchmarks. I would suggest you take a look at it, and if there are questions that relate to agencies as they come forward, then that you may want to highlight those in your discussion with them. With relationship to consumer and business services, their primary linkages are on the front page under the 9A, B, and C, having to do with the cost of doing business in Oregon. Although I will point out that 9B is not appropriate because they no longer have the Office of Energy, so you should probably strike that one. They are also related from the back under item 54 on page 2, having to do with health insurance. And with that, Mr. Chair, with your permission, mm-hmm. I think I'll move into the handout that I have done for the committee.
Probably you want me to go ahead now, because we did not open it to public hearing.
Oh, yes, so I probably do that.
Okay, so shall we open on 5059?
No, Mr. Chair, okay. I don't believe we need to.
Don't need to, just open a public hearing.
On 5011.
Yes. All right. With the tap of the gavel, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5011.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have actually, if you folks would probably just stay put because we're probably going to have questions, the committee's probably going to have questions to you related to this, and you do have copies that I
yes.
sent.
Yes, your
if not, there are extras on the table back there. The first issue, and that's one of the reasons that I asked the agency to stay at the table, it has to do with the agency's performance measures, and that is the other similar-looking handout that says budget narrative links to Oregon benchmarks. What I would like to do is have a discussion or have the committee have a discussion with the agency on the bench, on the performance measures and ensure that the committee is comfortable with the performance measures as presented. When we go into work session, we will be asking for there to be some ratification or partial ratification or instructions with ratification to the agency on these benchmarks. So I don't know if the committee has had a chance to look through these or if it would be helpful if we ask the agency to do a very brief walkthrough. There's an awful lot of them.
I think that would be a good idea.
Oh, all right.
I believe you've heard about a number of the specific performance measures during the presentation of our division, but we were delighted to walk through them again. Each of them we have tried to tie to one of our three primary goals, protecting workers and consumers in Oregon, providing excellent customer service, and regulating in a manner that supports a positive business climate. The first one is one that we're looking at primarily in our finance and corporate securities and workers' comp divisions, and that's the percentage of regulated entities operating in compliance with governing laws and regulations. The next one, and that one is in general support of our DCBS mission, but it hasn't been tied to one of these specific benchmarks. The next one does apply directly to benchmark number 9, and that's the percentage difference in wage recovery for workers who use our return to work program versus those who do not, and that's a specific performance measure for our workers' compensation division. In our insurance division, although this is something we will be looking at department-wide, is the percentage of confirmed complaints resolved with relief for the consumer. Our next goal, which relates directly to benchmark number 54 relating to the number of Oregonians with health insurance, is the number of Oregon medical insurance pool enrollees. You heard Rocky King talk about the functions of OMIP. Next, again, relating to workers' compensation, is the number of claims against employers without workers' compensation coverage. Of course, our goal there is to ensure that employers are, in fact, providing workers' compensation coverage. The following goal, also relating to workers' compensation, is the percent of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits. And the next and final goal under this general protection of consumers and workers is the number of Oregon employers who have voluntarily implemented outstanding safety and health programs. And I believe Pete DeLuca discussed with you the SHARP program and the voluntary protection program for employers relating to their compliance with safety and health.
Senator Carter.
Can you tell me, Ms. Streisinger, how many deaths we had in the state last year due to construction and
construction fatalities
and lack of safety?
That was one of the answers, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, my name is Greg Malkasian. We had provided a letter dated February 12th, and it's actually the attachment one if you have access to the letter, and it provides a significant amount of information. In the construction area in 2001, there were four fatalities in the private sector. And there were zero fatalities in the public sector under construction and zero in local government.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you help me just with the overall sort of what goes into these, what thinking goes into these? I was surprised with the first goal that the target for 2005 is 100%, because getting everybody to follow the law in anything just seemed like an impossibility to me. So I was surprised that was 100%. That's not a criticism. If you can get 100%, you go right to it. But then when we got down to, the further down, number of claims against employers without workers' compensation coverage, and we were down to 3. I figured that if everybody was following the law and regulations, they all had workers' compensation, and so we wouldn't have 3 down there. And just some of these, percent of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits, I was hoping that everybody would get those. So obviously I'm missing something. And so I'm just asking generally. It's not a criticism at all. I'm just trying to get a feel for the thought process behind the numbers here.
I'm going to ask Greg to answer that for you, since
I will confess
that I'm not here with that level of detail.
It's fine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it might help if we discuss just a little bit of the the process that we used with the division administrators and deputies in determining which key performance measures we should be tracking,
as well as the numbers.
And the and then also the fact that different divisions felt that they had different participation in each of these. And the far right column outlines those divisions that are participating in that key performance measure. And then it goes down to we have innumerable regulations and we had to identify the specific regulations that we felt would be most beneficial in communicating whether or not we were achieving the level of success or moving towards our target. And in the first example, the areas were in regulation over consumer finance companies, banks and trusts, credit unions, mortgage lenders, pawn brokers, and then insurers operating it in compliance with our laws and regulations.
So if I can maybe just elaborate on that a little.
Pawn brokers, I give you. There's how many of those in the state? Not very many. You can get 100% on them.
And I think this may answer your question about, is there a discrepancy between saying we want 100% compliance from regulated entities, yet our target is 3 out of 1,000 for employers complying? And I think the answer is in the, I hate to even say this, there is a footnote. In the first of the performance measures, you will see a teeny tiny little footnote number one, mm-hmm. which says that it's a compilation of some specific activities. Those are the ones Greg just read you. And they are the regulated entities, which for this measure is not employers, but rather the insurance side of workers' compensation. So the goal is for the providers of the workers' compensation insurance under this measure to be 100% in compliance. Employer compliance is measured separately by the other measure. I understand that it still appears to be an aggressive goal at 100%. A goal is something to strive for, but at least I think that's the explanation of why the numbers don't seem to match up exactly.
What I'm getting, Mr. Chair, is what I have begun to suspect, not with you guys, but with all of the budgets that I've heard in both of my subcommittees, and that's that I'm never going to understand the response to the benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it again and again, and it's not that they're doing anything wrong. It's just that the answer becomes so complex that anybody who isn't in the agency is going to struggle. For us, I need simple. And they can't give me simple and be completely honest. So
I think this is a mix of simple and complex. And one of the difficulties is we want to be able to measure the measurable, but also measure the right things. And it's a challenge to do both of those. I can guarantee that we would not want to come into you and say we need to add 5 positions to our data gathering staff in order to be able to measure precisely something that's the absolute clearest way to follow through on X. So we, to a certain extent, some of these are approximations. We have data in these areas. We can assemble data in 6 different regulatory programs and come as close as we pragmatically can to measuring compliance by regulated industries.
I'm understanding this. When answers to benchmarks have to have footnotes, I am in trouble before I ever get started.
I understand that, and many of them, I guess I would say they vary, and the agency has brought forward a mix of ones that are very clear and simple and ones that result from a breakdown of a more complex data. And I don't have a more complete answer for you than that. Some of these, I think, particularly the ones that relate to a single program and a single activity, are a lot easier to make very clear and straightforward. Ones that that are intended to reflect department activities as a whole are going to be more complex because the range of activity is so broad. How do you compare customer service from somebody getting a building codes permit to customer service from a credit union that's been through a financial exam? And what the department has done is rolled up a bunch of data sets and assigned percentages to each of them for some of those really global measures. But for some of the more specific ones, what you see is what you get.
But Mr. Chair, one thing, members of the committee, one thing I found helpful, because I, too, have difficulty sometimes, is that starts on the agency overview, page 24, which explains where they're getting the data from. Because that then puts the performance measure into some...
It's
on the handout.
Oh, that's 22.
I apologize.
Okay.
Yes. that puts the performance measure into a data collection context that tells you what the parameters are of what's being measured. And I find that helpful, especially when I look at something and go, what? what is being measured here? So I just refer you to that. I think it may help you track back to what they are attempting to report with these measures.
Senator Carter.
I'm wondering, Corey, let's just take this one for instance. The customer survey that you sent out. Number one, why did you send it out? Was there a problem area? You had 50 complaints in this particular area last year, and you're measuring how you can bring that complaint number down to where more compliance is. And then that's where the abstractism of it kind of fade away. And so if you're measuring a particular goal, I'm wondering if you might not give the committee some information in terms of we are measuring this goal because we had 50 complaints last year. We want 100% this next year because we want to do a better job, and it goes back to your efficiency issue in your central service where training is necessary. And if those two pieces are tied in, and you can show the committee the reason this piece is being measured because the benchmarks are there. But in measuring it, you're measuring this particular piece because there were some problem areas, and you had 50 complaints last year. You want to bring it down by 50% to 25 complaints. And that is certainly a goal that is not only measurable, but that you can see some instant outcomes once you send the respondents the surveys. And so what is measurable is that you had complaints or that you weren't as efficient in, and now you're seeking greater efficiency. If all that gobbledygook didn't sound so... But I think that's what I hear you saying here. That's what I'm looking at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we actually think it's important to measure customer satisfaction mm-hmm. on a continuous basis
right.
rather than just in areas where we've gotten a lot of complaints, because we need to know before we start.
Right. And I'm agreeing with that, but I'm saying how many dissatisfactions yes. did you have last year, so why are you measuring it?
The let me give you some of the breakdown that uh-huh. goes into the customer survey.
But I think that goes to Senator Duke. Is that what I was hearing you saying?
Well, I understood what you said, Senator. So that was a help.
Yeah, because in each of these areas, obviously what the state is calling for is great efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And when you seek efficiency, it's because either you've done a good job but you want to do better, or because you've had some problems in this area, i.e. the building construction codes and the construction contractors board, which many of us have experienced with both, say they need help. So when you get me, who is a dissatisfied customer, and you send me a survey, and I'm going to say, did you interact with this board, in these two boards, any time in the last year? Mm-hmm. I might say, no, but if I say yes, well, the service is better. Then I'm mm-hmm. going to probably say a little better.
Mm-hmm.
A little better is better than no better at all. And so therefore, you're going to measure that piece. And I think that maybe when you bring these measurables in terms of performance objectives before the committee, if you could just maybe just a little information in terms of even look at goal number one for DCBS mission, number of claims against employers without workers' compensation coverage per 1,000 total. How many did you have in that past year? How many did people find the workers, you know, a satisfied relationship with? I mean, it brings it out of the abstract, mm-hmm. and I think that's what I hear people saying, that it's much too abstract, not because you prepared the performance measures data, but because how you answering it is not coming over being very clear to the committee. And I've heard this in other committees as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, let me see if I can answer that. On the area of customer satisfaction,
okay.
we do currently have ongoing customer satisfaction feedback in a number of our areas.
Right.
And I would say it is pretty good. We get generally in the 90% plus positive range, and you'll see a roll-up of a number of different survey results right here. 2,000 value, you'll see 97%. We want to do 100. We want to get 100%.
How many complaints did you have that made customer satisfaction a measurable for you?
I'll have to get back to you on
that. I don't want that number. I'm just saying that it clarifies to the committee when they see these numbers mm-hmm. over here. It takes it out of the abstract.
Yeah. No, I see that. Generally, we survey in these areas, everybody who we've had an encounter with, when, for example, OSHA compliance efforts, everybody who has one of those encounters with OSHA, we don't wait to hear a complaint from them. We go ask them how we did. So these surveys are not done in response to complaints that we've received. But if what you're asking is how many of the survey respondents or people who we don't survey come to us and say, we have a problem with you.
Or we've done something good. I'm just saying that it takes it out of the abstract for committee members, and that's what I'm hearing people say.
Mm-hmm. We can get that information to you, and I believe actually we provided in one of our divisions, we got a request from you for what are the outcomes, and mm-hmm. we provided that to you. I have taken a look just recently myself at the OSHA information, because that's an area which in the past was a source of concern, and it's actually impressive results. The questions are things like, when the person who came to see you, were they professional? Were they respectful of your needs? Did they minimize disruption to your workforce? Were they timely? Did they explain why they were doing what they were doing? Did they explain what they did? Did you feel after that encounter that you had a good understanding of the result and you understood what why it came out the way it did? Those scores were very high. And those, it seems to me, are the questions we need to be asking, not just a kind of general, were you satisfied, but getting at the underlying issue of how did we interact with you. Because, you know, maybe you get a yes, I was satisfied, but in fact the underlying issue is that they said they would be there at a specific time, you had your staff lined up, and they didn't show. And we need to know that.
That's my point. I think that what I hear others saying, what I hear Senator Duke saying, they don't have a list of the measurables, i.e. the raw data, to know how did you come from that point to this point, saying mm-hmm. that you won 100% mm-hmm. For the 2003-2005 year. That's all I hear.
Representative Hanson, then Senator Duke.
On the same tack, I'll jump on this train before it leads too far down the road. I don't understand this at all, and it's maybe a little more global. Okay, if your goal is to provide excellent customer service, then why on earth would you accept a 97% rating of people that are saying that you're satisfactory or better? I mean, if your goal was to provide satisfactory customer service, this would be a reasonable goal. But by the same token, if you're only measuring satisfactory or better, one, that's not going to get you to excellence. The other one is you're measuring something where the increments, I mean, you're already there. We've heard a lot through this whole budget presentation that you really want to improve customer service. But I don't know, if I was at 97% success at something I was measuring, I wouldn't spend a dime to get from 97 to 100. I mean you've already accomplished the goal. So I don't understand. I think obviously what you mean is you want to get to a very high number of excellent service, but I don't understand why we're, unless it's just to kind of show puff, that we're already at 97%, so, but the other one, and then it's, is customer survey respondents of considering kind of the general feedback that we all get. My guess is there's a whole bunch of people that aren't sending that survey back in. And I kind of like, I mean, for it to be valid, you're getting 97% of rating your agency. The people that bothered to put it to send it back in, made, you know, unless you're getting 100% return on your surveys, then I don't know how valid that is. And then obviously, the participating divisions, when we're hearing most of our complaints and most of the concerns are building codes division, and it looks to me like they're not participating in this. So I don't, you know, I don't, I don't know how much real value I can put on this line as a real. I just don't think the way it's laid out here is just very important or very meaningful.
I apologize, but you made part of my point, because the number percent of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits is only 90%, mm-hmm. and yet the percent of satisfaction is 97%. Now maybe we're lumping. I would expect that those other 10% who didn't get timely and accurate benefits wouldn't be real happy with the agency, and so. Either they're getting lumped in with such a much larger group that they're getting lost, or they're not filling out the form and sending it back in. So I saw that and I questioned exactly the same thing, that the numbers don't make it look like we're where we think we are.
Senator George, and then maybe I can respond to both of those questions. With respect to customer service, our goal is 100%, and it is a roll-up of a number of different surveys, and you're quite right that today we are not surveying and collecting this data in all of our divisions. We need to do that. So the 90% is not necessarily based on all of our divisions. In addition, I believe that customer service and excellence in customer service requires continual effort. It's not something where you can declare success and stop ensuring that your workforce views it as a goal to be achieved. So even if we had a 2,000 value that were the same as our goal, I would think you would want us to keep that on our list.
I think my point is your goal is excellent customer service. You're measuring satisfactory customer service.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would you measure satisfactory if you really want excellence? Or if all you care about is getting to 100% of satisfactory, then your goal should be to provide satisfactory customer service, which I don't think that's what I'm hearing from the department.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a very good point. I thank you for clarifying that, because I do think our goal needs to be excellence. Satisfactory means it didn't really bother me today, but that's a little different than saying in this encounter it worked well, and that is our goal. So I will go back and we will work on this, because I think we need to look at the number of our customers whose experience with us is a good, solid, positive experience, not just a tolerable experience.
To 100% is satisfactory. Eliminate the people that say it's unsatisfactory, but have your excellent rating drop. The people that consider the service is excellent, which is contrary to your goal.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Getting back, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, to one of your questions, I don't know why the Building Codes Division isn't included in this measure, and it should be, in my view. We can't come to you with a measure that doesn't focus on the area that we need to focus on most and say, look at how good our numbers are. So I appreciate that as well.
Mr. Chair, members, it seems to me like there needs to be some subset of this that explains what the return on the survey was, too, so that it's in some sort mm-hmm. of context. I understand it shouldn't be a goal of yours to have some sort of return on the survey, because you have no control over that, but to put it into some sort of meaningful context, there needs to be some discussion of, you know, number of surveys and return.
We need to have a statistically valid
exactly.
survey process.
Yes. I have a question, and that is there an opportunity for folks to send back the response anonymously? I mean, does it come that way? Yeah. Because, you know, with some of the folks that are here, you might have fear of retaliation if you sent back something that wasn't very favorable. So they can. I see heads nodding out there.
Mr. Chair, yes. The answer is yes. In addition, this is an electronic survey rather than a paper survey, so we try to make it as easy for people as possible to respond.
Some of them.
They have an option. Some of them are paper surveys, I'm told.
Say, no, well, no wonder you're missing a whole section of people if it's electronic. Not everybody has access.
Are there other, Mr. Chair, yes. members, are there other specific concerns with goal number one?
Mm-hmm. Good for moving us along. We're going to spend a lot of time on this one. And we're already going into pieces.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we've already started to talk about goal number two. Mm-hmm. You can see some of the other more specific items within this. Several of these goals relate to benchmark number nine, dealing with the cost of doing business, but they also they're primarily focused on delivery of good service to our customers. The percentage of workers' comp board decisions which are affirmed on appeal, the percentage of timelines for key department activities that are met, and you'll see that that covers a number of different activities. So this again is one where it's not a single measure. It's a cluster of measures of individual timelines which have been identified within the department as particularly sensitive. And then the percentage of customer transactions completed electronically. And although, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, you're quite correct that certainly not everybody has electronic access, for a number of the regulated industries that we deal with, most of them do, and it's a considerable savings in time and cost for them if we can't allow them to interact with us electronically. That one, however, is a, as you can see, it's got a percentage number that's pretty small because we're still at the beginning stages of moving to e-commerce. The third major cluster of these performance measures is regulating in a manner that supports a positive business climate. And a number of these initiatives are specific to one of our divisions. Some of them are clusters. The percentage of OROSHA employer consultations where the consultant works actively with employee safety committees. Our experience is that safety consultations work best if it's a joint effort with employers and employees. The next one you've heard about from our Building Codes Division, and that's building permits issued that can be used in multiple jurisdictions for minor construction work. That's building on the success of our Tri-County center, but as you can see there, too, this is a process that's just starting, and there's a long way to go because of the multiplicity of local jurisdictions that really control that process. The next one is the percentage of workers' benefit fund expenditures determined to be eligible. And this is, you'll again have to look at the footnote there for an explanation, and we can certainly provide you with a more detailed explanation if you wish. The next goal under this is general cluster is also a workers' compensation division program, and that is an increase in the number of eligible workers essentially who use our return to work programs. Those return to work programs are a way to reduce costs for the system overall by getting workers back to work early. The next one relates to our use of input from stakeholders, and it applies to a number of our divisions, and that relates to the use of stakeholder groups in the rulemaking process. The second to the last goal on this sheet reflects use of alternative dispute resolution rather than a formal hearings process, which not only keeps costs down but also is more customer-friendly. And the final one, which I believe you heard about some from the Building Codes Division, is an attempt to minimize the number of Oregon-specific changes to national model building codes.
Mr. Chair, the last one, I don't quite understand what the 85% relates to. 85% of what?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I can't give you a maybe Mr. Caucasian can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe when Mr. Long was here, he was talking about the goal of reducing the number of Oregon-specific changes to the national code, and those are generally done by requests that come into the division. And I think he talked about the goal to minimize the number of actual changes and also to transition to a three-year adoption.
So is the 85%, 85% of the changes come in being adopted, or that it's 85% of the total code, or what? What's the 85% relate to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, could we get that information back to you?
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm happier. There's one they don't understand.
That's what I just said. We're not setting up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a broad question. It has to do with the amount of cost that we expend to establish the benchmarks, the performance measures, and then the testing and the overhead that goes into driving this whole system of the FTEs that you have in your department of central support. I assume it's in central support of 191. How many of those employees would be dedicated almost exclusively, or a major portion, or put it in an FTE perspective, that are dedicated to managing this information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, when we developed these performance measures, we felt they shouldn't, in the actual tracking of the performance measures, should not detract from our ability to provide service to our customers, the public. And so we specifically tried to focus, as one of our criteria for adopting measures, was those that were measurable, that could be based upon data that's captured within our system. So other than the actual cost of setting up that system of capturing the data, we hope that it's a matter of pressing a button in our management information system to come have the counts come out. So the initial setup of the time that the division administrators and us took to develop them was just a period in time. And I think the ongoing effort, other than those that are manual counts, which would be pretty limited, should be minor.
Thank you. That was the right answer, by the way.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that we've created things that cost a lot of money to track.
That was my question. Thank you. Any further questions?
Then, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my notes indicate that the two things that we really need the agency to come back with is a modification to the goal number 2, having to do with excellent customer service, and to work on number 3, which, and at least explain what number 3, the building code modifications are.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamont, so that's our, in the PM number, that's actually the number 8 and number 18 in that column that says PM number right after the key performance?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
With that I'd like to move on
back
to we're back to the to
the
my
memorandum.
Handout. Number 2 is just to get a consensus from the committee that the merit pay amount should be reduced by $1,913,183 to reflect the elimination of the 2,305 merit increases. If there's, I'm not going to ask for any, but unless I hear some concern about that.
My thank you. My concern is not to eliminate it, or is not. I agree with the need to eliminate it as well as with the next one, but clearly we need a full ways and means discussion or some direction in terms of just these are other, almost all other funds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
the purpose of eliminating the merit pay increases and stuff was to ease the burden on the general fund. I don't think we're holding employees flat at a flat income level, and this is as flat of an income level as I think I've ever seen in government. In terms, even when we did a pay freeze in Multnomah County, merit increases continued even though we eliminated all cost of living adjustments. So this is real hardball in terms of the impact that we're going to have on our employees and on their families. I don't think we're doing that so that we can reduce fees that are acceptable within the industry. We need to be doing this so somehow there's a mechanization so this can help with the general fund crisis that we're in. And that's outside of
right.
That's outside of this discussion. But
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was the direction of the governor that all state employees be treated the same, and that's the issue here. However, with regard to this agency, it would seem to me that the recommendation I would bring forward is that any savings that accrue, for example, to the building codes division, mm-hmm. where there's a clear need, would then be used to offset any of the reductions that are being made to the building codes division. Likewise with number three, which is the reduction of limitation for inflation, any of that reduction that can be applied to building codes to offset their shortfall, I would probably be recommending mm-hmm. that those funds then be reinvested, as it were, in building codes to offset their shortfall. But with regard to the rest of the agency, clearly the intent is that all state agencies be treated the same for this biennium so that there's no inflation adjustment, there's no merit, there's no cost of living adjustment regardless of the funding source.
Mr. Chair, how does this affect PERS? In other words, if the wages aren't going up and the money's not going into PERS, is there going to be some savings?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are not complete numbers. And LFO recognizes that there's other adjustments that are going to need to be made. For example, the governor's direction that the cost of living adjustment that was granted for managers at salary range 24 and above be rescinded. Though there will be some savings there. We will have to look again and make sure that this merit pay number accurately reflects the cost of the agency, and that would include any PERS adjustments, any adjustments that end up happening with other things such as health care costs. So this is based on what we know today, and I'm just trying to get a sense of the committee that, you know, that this is the approach to take, but it will be adjusted when we go into work session for actual, including PERS.
Director, let me ask this discussion relative to what Raman said, and that is, are you able to take the different sections of the agency and move them? In other words, savings in one area, can you move it to the other section?
Mr. Chair, only in some very limited areas. It depends on the funding source. For example, both our Workers' Compensation Division and our OSHA division are funded through, in part, the Workers' Compensation Premium Assessment, but the Building Codes Division is funded through its separate source. So the ability to, we don't have the ability to transfer funds among divisions across the board.
Senator Dukes.
Mr. Chair, when we get to work session, whenever that is, mm-hmm. Not just from your agency, from all agencies that are other funds, I'm going to want to know where the money's going, what it's going to do. Is it going to sit in a fund? Is it going to reduce fees? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to it?
That's where I was headed.
Yeah, but something in concrete black and white that I can try to understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes. Greg Malocasian again. We had discussed in one of the letters the dynamic financial model that is developed, and any actual expenditure that is reduced, and this would be a forecasted expenditure, actually is factored into that model and goes into that determination of the ending cash balance necessary and the fees required. So it would likely result in a reduction, potentially could result, depending upon economic circumstances and all those things, in potentially all, if all the else is the same, it would result in a reduction of fees.
But I guess when we get to the end, Mr. Chair, Satish will provide you with the numbers when we're finished fiddling around here. And then I just want to know what happens. Which ones get fee reductions, which ones go into the ending balance, which ones, you know, what other options there are out there.
Representative Pence?
Well, yeah, this is going to be, I think, real complicated through this, because looking at three different divisions, you've got three complete different causes and effects. Mm-hmm. In building code, we're trying to get a fee increase to cover a shortfall. All right, we're not going to reduce fees there because the employees are working cheaper. In the finance, I believe what we heard was that wage reductions or holding it steady would create in a benefit to the general fund because they're fixed fees with the surplus going to the general fund. And then in the insurance division, we're talking about cutting, the effect would be to cut fees. And yet, we're saying the reason we're doing this is to be consistent across the levels of state government, but we're not being consistent in terms of what the results are. And it's going to be a real difficult thing to work through. And I think it's going to cause... Anyway.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just express a caution that if we work, you know, really creatively to shift funds from accounts that are really specific to specific uses into general fund uses, I mean, even if it was legal, my red flags just really go up, because we could go down a path that you could have a hard time unwinding in the future. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend that we not even think about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will not be recommending that because, by and large, you would not be doing something that is legal. The only place I would be looking would be any place we could potentially legally shift funds to support building codes because of the shortfall. And that, you know, that factors into, you know, overhead costs and other factors like that. But I echo your caution, and I echo it in part because the people who pay these fees expect these fees to be used for the purposes for which they were collected. So,
and I think each one of us have had the issues that occurred, some of the things that occurred during the special sessions in which funds were collected. Folks thought they were going to go for a specific purpose, only to find out that we took them. And the other thing was is that they thought they were going to get them back, and now they're being told, no, you won't. And so that, you know, the idea of rating funds, you know, which village do we do next, and do they do our village next? And so I think it's very critical. And obviously, we're, particularly this committee, where we have, 98% of everything we deal with is, you know, dedicated. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of flexibility, but we are carrying out what the governor asked us to do, and here we are.
On item number 3, it is the same discussion we just had on merit pay. That is going to be a uniform recommendation for all state agencies. Again, when I come forward with recommendations, I will be looking at what those savings reflect in building codes and what they can be used for in terms of offsetting their costs. On number 4, I believe Rocky King discussed the fact that their original budget recommendation was built on an assumption of a certain level of
insurance, or people being insured through the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the governor reduced that assumption significantly, which results in an adjustment of just under $70 million in the non-limited account. You won't be asked to take any action with regard to this, but LFO will be recommending that the agency make that adjustment to more accurately reflect what the workload will be.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, Robin, could you refresh my memory? OMAP is essentially user paid, and there's an assessment that goes against the insurance companies on a premium per month.
Right.
And it's a self-liquidating fund.
Correct.
So if we're reducing it by $70 million, what are we accomplishing?
What we are doing is that, and we aren't, non-limited is just that. The legislature doesn't establish a limitation. The agency comes forward with what they think that fund will actually use during the biennium. The governor and the agency could speak to why he did this, but the governor reduced the estimated enrollment in the pool, which then reduces the amount of money that would be needed to pay the third-party administrator to pay the claims. So this is just simply to reflect the reduction in the estimated enrollment. And that reflects a reduction in the estimated cost to the pool.
Well, that's good.
Sure. Certainly.
Thank you. If we are reducing the OHP to the extent that we're driving people out of that, does that increase the OMIP rather than decrease it?
I'm going to let them speak to this because they're the experts in that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, OMIP is a premium-based program, so it can only enroll people who can afford the premium. Even though there is a premium subsidy, the premium subsidy makes up the difference in cost between what someone generally would pay for health insurance and the extra costs that are attributed to the fact that this is a high-risk pool. But participants need to be able to afford the same standard group premium that would be charged if they were not in that high-risk pool. So Oregon Health Plan participants, by and large, are not the same population as is served by this pool.
The FEOP participants would be, though, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the FEOP participants could have some overlap, although there is a privately paid component there, too, but that is not included within this budget. Although Rocky King manages both programs, one is within DCBS and one is not, and I believe you will be seeing the FEOP budget at a later time.
Senator Dukes?
How comfortable are you with the estimates that this is now based on, this reduction is based on? I guess I'm trying to determine whether we're in the next 2 years are likely to have to say, no, we can't accommodate you to someone who comes looking for this program.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is this action wouldn't affect the ability of OMIP to handle an increased number of enrollees.
It's still safe and we just run out of money?
No, Mr. Chair, no. Members of the committee, the non-limited budget would increase based on the enrollment and the assessment that's charged. Non-limited, this action is just simply to reduce the estimate of what we think that non-limited account is going to have running through it. If, in fact, that estimate is wrong, the next budget will reflect the actual amount that's going through it. I'm just trying to clean up the books. That's all I'm trying to do.
So this isn't the piece that provides the subsidy?
No, this, in fact, this, in fact, has no effect on their ability to do anything. It just simply reduces the amount that is reflected in the budget based on our best estimate of what that account is going to churn through it.
You have a puzzled look. Would you like to ask another question?
Mr. Chair, I guess the cynic in me suggests that tell me this isn't true.
Well, I just wrote a strange note, so go ahead. Let's
this is not a political maneuver, is it?
I do not.
No, that's an unfair question. Well, I retract the question.
I am not actually familiar with why the governor made the decision that he did. But I do know that, and I'm not sure what factors went into the decision that was made in terms of what the forecasted amount of people going through OMIP would be. But the non-limited accounts are established because there is no way for an agency to control those dollars, that it is an ongoing program with dedicated funds, that is hard to explain, that are not subject to the agency's management or control in terms of how they are expended. And examples are workers' compensation payments or unemployment insurance payments. We've got a variety of different accounts where that is the case. So there were assumptions made in building this budget about the number of people that would be provided services through OMED. That number was reduced downward as part of the governor's budget building process. And so I'm just simply trying to reflect what the account should look like based on what we know today about the number of enrollees. But this is assessments that come from insurers to fund the actual persons who are enrolled in that account.
I'll drop it, Mr. Chairman. But it would appear to me that some of these non-limited funds, you can change the assumptions, and you change the total global budget period, so that or budget amount, so you can then say we've cut government by X when you really haven't cut it.
What I would like
that
to
was the,
right.
Was
what
the,
I would like to suggest, Mr. Chair and members, is that before we go into work session, before we take any actual action on this, that we ask Mr. King to come back and explain what the decision making process was.
See what the trends are.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And the last issue that I have on this list, and I don't know, just to be on the safe side, why don't we open a public hearing on the fee bill?
All right.
I'm going to close a public hearing on 5011, open a public hearing on House Bill 5059.
My question to the committee is to get a sense of where they are on the fee bill, whether or not there is any interest in pursuing the fee bill, and if not, what recommendations the committee might have for LFO and the agency in terms of trying to deal with the issue in building codes then of the shortfall.
Where is the fee bill? Is it here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You have it in front of you.
Yeah. It would be nice if we could collect all of the potential fee bills out there and shuffle them all down to Ways and Means. For example, I saw the other day, not a budget bill, but a bill introduced by a legislator that would increase some of their fees.
Mm-hmm.
Fees that purportedly have not been raised since 1960. And I assume it's been assigned to a substantive committee. And it just occurs to me that these things may be littered throughout the building.
Right.
And we're hard-pressed to do a budget when there are substantive committees that may or may not be reporting out bills. It just seems as though it would be helpful if we had all of them before us when we considered a particular budget so that we could make logical decisions based on all of it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if in fact a fee bill involves additional funding for an agency operation, it would need to come to Ways and Means so that the limitation could be established or increased.
The difficulty is it might come to Ways and Means eventually.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that very often happens. Then it happens that bills are passed after budgets have come out, and there is then a process to increase the limitation based on that.
It seems that this session, when money is so short, it would be nice to make those decisions.
To the best of my knowledge, there are no other fee bills involving this agency.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe the only one we have heard of that anyone has been considering is, in fact, the one that Senator Walker's been working on, which relates to securities fees, I believe, which are statutory. The fees that are set out in 5059 are non-statutory fees that are established through an administrative process and then reviewed by the legislature. If there are any others that we become aware of course, we will share that information right away.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, the sense that I get in talking to the industry, those affected by this fee increase, is that the department is doing a good job, and they want to make certain that they continue to be timely. That's mm-hmm. the biggest issue is timeliness in construction. Any kind of delays are just disastrous, and to have that timely response and assurance of that is important to them, and the industry is supporting this bill. I've talked to no one that is opposed to the fee increase. So barring that, I think I would vote accordingly.
Senator Hanson, then Senator
Hall, I think.
I'll be representative.
Still, sir. Still represented.
That's what happens when you're trying to think of two things and talk at the same time.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in very much in agreement on the fee bill. It's something that's asked by the industry. It primarily focuses on rural areas because that's where that level of service where that the service is being delivered, and I just can't envision how you can get timely construction work done without keeping manpower up for the inspectors.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, these are the fees that are on here. There's existing fees.
Senator George, Representative Krieger, yes, most of them are existing fees. I believe we provided you with a matrix.
What page is that on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Show the fee increases, the differences, what I mean.
Yes, the agency handed out a matrix on the day that we had that overview, and I
mm-hmm. I'd be interested in looking at that. I can look it up.
That was the 13th answer, the back of the 13th answer.
Mr. Chair, actually, it was presented at the time of the hearing on the fee bill. I think that was on Wednesday, the 12th.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. On all the fee bills I've seen so far, like in Natural Ways and Means, Marine Board, Lindsay Ball, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, I'm familiar with that one that's coming. I know specifically what that money is going to do. Do we have somewhere? Is this keeping people out there? And is it more people? Because if we're not giving them a raise, you wouldn't need more money if you're not going to give them a raise to keep the same number of people out there.
Senator George, Representative Krieger, I believe the table that you have outlines specifically what each of the fees does, and they are clustered. So, for example, the issue that's raised by our policy packages and dealing with provision of inspection services to rural Oregon in particular, in package 191, is reflected in a cluster of fees which essentially represent a 25% fee increase in the electrical program. But because there are many different individual fees that make up that program, you will see a list which we've grouped together in that matrix. Some of the other fees in the building codes area reflect, for example, new programs instituted by the legislature last session, which the department was directed to put in place and assess a fee to cover the cost. There's a training program, for example, that falls in that category.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, Representative Krieger, Greg Malkasian here. These fees will basically be the support for our recommended passage of the Package 191 in the Building Codes Division budget, which restores, actually maintains 9.58 FTE in the coming year. So it's specifically those positions that would be maintained in the course of the next year rather than being brought down, and that was the issue of provision of service. And I believe the majority of them were electrical inspectors, if I'm correct.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I will do during the interim while we wait for the work session is that I will work with the department to see if there are savings that can be achieved that might, in fact, affect the amount of fee increase that is requested.
Robin, I think that, you guys correct me if you don't agree with this, but I think that was kind of our degree of heartburn over central support services as to whether we were just having a fee increase that didn't add to do the ads that we needed just relative to in the field people only to support an additional increase in central support services. And so we can get that clear in our mind. I think, you know, that Representative Kensler.
Well, yeah, when we go, when Robin does all this extra work, which is everything keeps changing, because if you reduce the merit pay and the cost of living and central support, then you reduce the transfer out of building codes, and then at the same time you're reducing the merit increases and stuff in building codes. Then you get the next question, and I'd sure like to get some feedback from the industry. What we're using the fee increase for is to add back 9 of roughly 32 positions that have been cut. Okay, these are industry-driven charges that they, at this point, are very willing to accept. The big question then is, as you do those budget adjustments, do you lower the amount of the fee increase to add to keep consistent with adding back 9 positions, or do you do those budget savings to increase the number that you're adding back from like 9 to 16 or 9 to 14 or whatever it works out. And I'd sure like to get some input from the industry before I really commit which of those I think is more valid.
Thank you.
Also, how that aligns, if we're able to add the additional personnel, how that aligns with what the expectation is for those construction activities. And you feel like you poured it into a bowl and now we're stirring it up. Now hopefully something comes out of this. But
the other possible position that we might want to take is if building activities continue to go into the proverbial toilet with a large flushing noise, whether we need to keep that as some level of contingency, because if building activity falls and permitting activity falls, you've got a decrease in revenue. But kind of where this particular activity is so tough to fund, when you're talking about covering the most rural parts of the state, the amount of time that the inspectors have to spend going out to job sites is huge. Well, if they're covering four jobs in that period in a day's work, you don't get back to the office any earlier if you're only covering 3, because you've still got the distance between jobs and you've still got. On the other hand, if you're only covering 3, if there's only 25 less work, 25% less activity going on in that area. The workload really doesn't drop, but the revenue is going to drop by 25%. And it may be that, I don't know, maybe that's something that we need to keep in those benefits from the inflation decreases. Might need to be kept in reserve so that they're not going to have to be laying off more inspectors through the budget year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're trying to maintain this infrastructure so that when we do get recovery, that there's actually going to be a mechanism to handle the inspections that will be needed.
Yeah. But Mr. Chair, members, there are ways that we could do a contingency budget, mm-hmm. that is to grant them a certain level of limitation and direct them to come back to the emergency board for an increase if, in fact, things, you know, fall off the table or whatever. So, you know, we can think about whether or not, you know, we want to do that.
What's the reaction to that? That's kind of in the back of my mind ever since I first question I asked, you know, since we have so much dedicated fund, non-limited, why are we doing this? And should we be looking at building contingency funds just in case there is a downturn in which the fee base is gone? Any input from you guys on that?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, the question would be, would the committee want to support the fee bill? And some, you know, and perhaps the FTE, that is, restore what cuts we can, approve the fee bill and FTE, but keep some portion of that in reserve. That is, in reserve that they cannot spend. They'll have the money, mm-hmm. but and ask them then to come back and have a discussion with the emergency board, you know, the midpoint in the biennium. But I think, you know, there are so many factors that we need to look at, mm-hmm. at this point that I couldn't make, you know, a recommendation as to how to deal with it right now.
Well, I'd like to ask those who are going to manage this, what is your opinion on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, the first decision is, of course, on the fee bill, and we would certainly be happy to come back and have a discussion with the emergency board at an appropriate time to see how the revenues are coming in. Our concern is that we're able to continue to deliver the services and not have any of those multiplicity of accounts dip below a responsible level. And we're happy to cooperate in whatever mechanism you'd like to put together for that purpose.
Chairman, the fees that are new fees, and then there's an increase of 25% for existing fees, which generates X amount of money, which would support an increase of X number of FTEs to manage that program, correct? And I'm asking this as a kind of an uninformed legislator, I guess, in terms of the process. But it would seem to me that if we authorize that, the fee and the corresponding FTE, then you would then manage within that based on the demand. And that would be the direction legislatively. You always have the ability to reduce if the FTEs and manage the workforce within the demand of work required, as opposed to having to come back and micromanage from the standpoint of the legislature.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, that's correct. If the fees, even at the level that is set by the fee bill, if there's an additional economic downturn and the revenue doesn't come in at the level of that's predicted, we would expect that to be our management responsibility to deal with.
Right. Well, that gets me, Mr. Chair, members, to, I think, my last question, which it doesn't have a number. Are there other issues or concerns that LFO and the agency should be prepared to address when we come back in work session? Sort of a general, what are the other issues, if there are any, that the committee would like me to work on?
Well, let's do this. If we can't think of them right now, we can bring them to you.
Yes, you can.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there anything further?
I don't think so.
Well, we're going to hear it early today.
Yeah.
Then. Okay. Any other comments or questions? If not, we will be adjourned.
Thank you.